History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And as we tell you every week, they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Last time, we met a 103-year-old Royal Air Force veteran named Ron Holdsworth, and I want to thank those of you who showed up in Bakersfield, California, to welcome him home from his soaring valor trip to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, thanks to the Gary Sinise Foundation. Another group of World War II vets right now is on a special mission to Pearl Harbor and the USS Missouri, where 80 years ago this week, on September 2nd, 1945, leaders from the United States and Imperial Japan signed the Instruments of Surrender, officially ending hostilities in the most destructive war the world has ever experienced. The You Were Worth It Foundation is in Hawaii right now with 11 special World War II veterans who are going to mark that 80th anniversary on the deck where it happened. Not in Tokyo Bay, but where the Mighty Mo now resides as a museum ship just across Pearl Harbor from the USS Arizona Memorial. There will also be an 80th anniversary commemoration Tuesday, September 2nd at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You can register online to attend in person, or you can follow the live stream. And I'll be marking the occasion by speaking at a special ceremony in California. I'll tell you about that a little later. There will also be an 80th anniversary commemoration Tuesday, September 2nd at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You can register online to attend in person, or you can follow the live stream. And I'll be marking the occasion by speaking at a special ceremony in California. I'll tell you about that a little later. But as we prepare for the last in a series of World War II 80th anniversaries we've been moving through, let's start with the words transmitted over some of these very same radio airwaves at the time, sent from the battleship Missouri, where General Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Chester Nimitz had the chance to caption the occasion they'd been dreaming of after nearly 4 years of war. If you were alive at the time, you might remember MacArthur saying, "Today the guns are silent." But after having to flee the Philippines 3.5 years earlier, then return and help spread freedom in the Pacific, MacArthur had a lot more to say than just that.
"My fellow countrymen, today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed. And in reporting this to you, the people, I speak for the thousands of silent lips forever stilled among the jungles and the beaches and in the deep waters of the Pacific which mark the way. I speak for the unnamed brave millions homeward bound to take up the challenge of that future which they did so much to salvage from the brink of disaster. As I look back on the long, tortuous trail from those grim days of Bataan and Corregidor, when an entire world lived in fear, when democracy was on the defensive everywhere, when modern civilization trembled in the balance, I thank a merciful God that he has given us the faith, the courage, and the power from which to mold victory. We have known the bitterness of defeat and the exaltation of triumph. And from both, we have learned there can be no turning back. We must go forward to preserve in peace what we won in war. A new era is upon us. Even the lesson of victory itself brings it profound concern, both for our future security and the survival of civilization. The destructiveness of the war potential through progressive advances in scientific discovery has, in fact, now reached a point which revises the traditional concept of war. Men, since the beginning of time, have sought peace. Various methods through the ages have been attempted to devise an international process to prevent or settle disputes between nations. From the very start,
workable methods were found insofar as individual citizens were concerned. But the mechanics of an instrumentality of larger international scope have never been successful. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blots out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we do not devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon will be at our door. The problem, basically, is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescence and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advance in science, art, literature, and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. We stand in Tokyo today, reminiscent of our countryman, Commodore Perry, 92 years ago. His purpose was to bring to Japan an era of enlightenment and progress by lifting the veil of isolation to the friendship, trade, and commerce of the world. But alas, the knowledge thereby gained of Western science was forged into an instrument of oppression and human enslavement. Freedom of expression, freedom of action, even freedom of thought were denied through suppression of liberal education, through appeal to superstition, and through the application of force. We are committed by the Potsdam Declaration of Principles to see that the Japanese people are liberated from this condition of slavery. It is my purpose to implement this commitment just as rapidly as the armed forces are demobilized and other essential steps taken to neutralize the war potential. The energy of the Japanese race, if properly directed, will enable expansion vertically rather than horizontally. If the talents of the race are turned into constructive channels, the country can lift itself from its present deplorable state into a position of dignity. To the Pacific Basin has come the vista of a new emancipated world. Today, freedom is on the offensive. Democracy is on the march. Today, in Asia as well as in Europe, unshackled peoples are tasting the full sweetness of liberty, the relief from fear. In the Philippines, America has evolved a model for this new free world of Asia. In the Philippines, America has demonstrated that peoples of the East and peoples of the West may walk side by side in mutual respect and with mutual benefit. The history of our sovereignty there has now the full confidence of the East. And so, my fellow countrymen, today I report to you that your sons and daughters have served you well and faithfully with the calm, deliberate, determined fighting spirit of the American soldier and sailor based upon a tradition of historical trait as against the fanaticism of an enemy supported only by mythological fiction. Their spiritual strength and power has brought us through to victory. They are homeward bound. Take care of them.
That was General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers. We will now hear Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, United States Navy, the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet.
On board all naval vessels at sea and in port and at our many island bases in the Pacific, there is rejoicing and thanksgiving. The long and bitter struggle which Japan started so treacherously on the 7th of December, 1941, is at an end. I take great pride in the American forces which have helped to win this victory. America can be proud of them. The officers and men of the United States Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and Merchant Marine who fought in the Pacific have written heroic new chapters in this nation's military history. I have infinite respect for their courage, resourcefulness, and devotion to duty. We also acknowledge the great contribution to this victory made by our valiant allies. United we fought, and united we prevail. The port of Tokyo, which was first opened by Commodore Perry in 1853, is now crowded with United States men of war. The process of bringing Japan into the family of civilized nations, which was interrupted when Japan launched her program of conquest, will soon begin again. Today, all freedom-loving peoples of the world rejoice in the victory and feel pride in the accomplishments of our combined forces. We also pay tribute to those who defended our freedom at the cost of their lives. On Guam is a military cemetery in a green valley not far from my headquarters. The ordered rows of white crosses stand as reminders of the heavy cost we have paid for victory. On these crosses are the names of American soldiers, sailors, and Marines. Culpepper, Tomino, Sweeney, Bromberg, Depew, Malloy, Ponziani. Names that are a cross-section of democracy. They fought together as brothers in arms. They died together, and now they sleep side by side. To them, we have a solemn obligation, the obligation to ensure that their sacrifice will help to make this a better and safer world in which to live. To achieve this, it will be necessary for the United Nations to enforce rigidly the peace terms that will be imposed upon Japan. It will also be necessary to maintain our national strength at a level which will discourage future acts of aggression aimed at the destruction of our way of life. Now we turn to the great tasks of reconstruction and restoration. I am confident that we will be able to apply the same skill, resourcefulness, and keen thinking to these problems as were applied to the problems of winning the victory.
And you can be the judge of how that worked out. Admiral Chester Nimitz, 80 years ago, on September 2nd, 1945, aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. Follow the You Were Worth It Foundation on social media to see how some special VIPs, 11 World War II veterans, experienced the 80th anniversary aboard the Mighty Mo in Hawaiian waters this week. And when we come back, how President Truman marked the occasion 80 years ago, as well as a few veterans who were there in Tokyo Bay, including one who had just begun to taste freedom again after years in captivity. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we prepare for the final 80th anniversary from World War II, the official end of the war on September 2nd, 1945. The Stories Behind the Stars project set an ambitious goal, trying to capture the stories of all 421,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II by the time this 80th anniversary rolled around. They're not quite there yet, but they are closing in on 75,000 of those Gold Star Heroes stories compiled. That's actually more than the number of American World War II veterans who are still living today. And if you want to be a part of that volunteer effort, go to storiesbehindthestars.org. And we're going to try to get an update from the founder of that initiative for you soon. Among those we've met over the years who were present in Tokyo Bay 80 years ago were a couple of tin can sailors with interesting assignments. Here's what Lee Kaiser told us about the orders given to his ship, the USS Wilson.
At the end of the war, when the USS Missouri went into the surrender, we were in the area patrolling. Our order was to, during the ceremony for the surrender, that in case any Vogue Japanese pilot, they didn't want to surrender, shoot them down immediately, but shoot anybody else down. Any other plane in the area, hit them so that they wouldn't fly into the Missouri. And that was our job.
And there was an even more extensive role for the destroyer USS Lardner, as we once heard here from Mike Wanty.
I think for about 3 months, we went back and forth out to sea from Tokyo, and the planes bombarded Tokyo and all around there. And then the war was ended. We were given the honor to be the first ones in Tokyo Harbor.
Your ship?
Yeah, which I didn't think was the best honor. Our captain was smart enough. We went to general quarters, and we had those guns pointed, loaded. There was two Japanese destroyers on either side of us, and he was nervous. We didn't know what they were going to do. They had done kamikaze.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they try and blow up that ship? So we never stopped for about 2 days. We went around and around in the harbor because we were afraid of these one-man submarines, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Was that before they signed the surrender in
yes.
Tokyo Bay?
Yeah.
So you guys went in to kind of make sure that was safe.
That's right. Exactly.
So you were expendable.
Yes.
You were the ones that didn't care if you got blown up.
We always were.
You're a destroyer.
Right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Always were. We were lucky we never got hit. The lucky Lardner.
So you guys get word that Japan is going to surrender?
Yeah, we were at sea and everybody cheered.
But they tell you, you're the first ones in.
We had to go pick up a few of the battle wagons, but we were the lead ship.
Uh-huh.
And we went on in. The battle wagons in the Missouri followed quite a few days after. We were at anchor then, and they anchored very close to us. So I could, with my binoculars, watch everything that was going on.
So you guys circle the harbor. You've got your guns out and all that. You make sure everything's fine. And then you drop anchor and wait for the bigger ships and the dignitaries.
Right.
And so you said you could watch through your binoculars. So were you looking that way when all the bigwigs got on there?
Oh, sure. And then after it was signed, then we had to go pick up prisoners of war. We went north and picked up some prisoners of war, brought them back. By that time, a hospital ship was anchored in Tokyo Bay, and we would deliver them.
And we're going to hear from a couple of prisoners of war before our hour is done. Jack Schwartz had been captured on Guam the day after the war began. He was a prisoner for longer than the U.S. was officially at war, because his last prison camp wasn't liberated until after that September 2nd signing on the battleship Missouri.
The war was over August the 14th. But we were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks, and it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us. And 2 hours later, a parachute was dropping out of the cab full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
Kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of it anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads. And we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy, and they put the Navy people aboard the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags. And they gave us uniforms. They wore cappy uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the planes and fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us. Because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody.
So VJ Day in mid-August didn't mean everyone was out of the woods. And not even that formal surrender on September 2nd wrapped things up for prisoners like Jack Schwartz, who hadn't been liberated yet. But the significance of what took place on the USS Missouri was underscored for millions of Americans listening to some of these very radio stations you're listening to right now by one of Missouri's native sons, our 33rd president, Harry Truman.
My fellow Americans, Supreme Allied Commander General MacArthur and Allied representatives on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay. The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender. 4 years ago, the thoughts and fears of the whole civilized world were centered on another piece of American soil, Pearl Harbor. The mighty threat to civilization which began there is now laid at rest. It was a long road to Tokyo and a bloody one. We shall not forget Pearl Harbor. The Japanese militarists will not forget the USS Missouri. The evil done by the Japanese warlords can never be repaired or forgotten. But their power to destroy and kill has been taken from them. Their armies, and what is left of their navy, are now impotent. To all of us, there comes first a sense of gratitude to Almighty God, who sustained us and our allies in the dark days of grave danger, who made us to grow from weakness into the strongest fighting force in history, and who has now seen us overcome the forces of tyranny that sought to destroy his civilization. God grant that in our pride of this hour, we may not forget the hard tasks that are still before us, that we may approach these with the same courage, zeal, and patience with which we faced the trials and problems of the past 4 years. Our first thoughts, of course, thoughts of gratefulness and deep obligation, go out to those of our loved ones who have been killed or maimed in this terrible war. On land and sea and in the air, American men and women have given their lives so that this day of ultimate victory might come and assure the survival of a civilized world. No victory can make good their loss. We think of those whom death in this war has hurt, taking from them fathers, husbands, sons, brothers and sisters whom they love. No victory can bring back the faces they long to see. Only the knowledge that the victory, which these sacrifices have made possible, will be wisely used, can give them any comfort. It is our responsibility, ours, the living, to see to it that this victory shall be a monument worthy of the dead who died to win it. All millions of men and women in our armed forces and merchant marines, all over the world, who, after years of sacrifice and hardship and peril, have been spared by Providence from harm. We think of all the men and women and children who, during these years, have carried on at home in lonesomeness and anxiety and fear. Our thoughts go out to the millions of American workers and businessmen, to our farmers and miners, to all those who have built up this country's fighting strength and who have shipped to our allies the means to resist and overcome the enemy. Our thoughts go out to our civil servants and to the thousands of Americans who, at personal sacrifice, have come to serve in our government during these trying years. To the members of the Selective Service Boards and Ration Boards, to the Civilian Defense and Red Cross workers, to the men and women in the USO and in the entertainment world, to all those who have helped in this cooperative struggle to preserve liberty and decency in the world. We think of our departed gallant leader, Franklin D. Roosevelt, defender of democracy, architect of world peace and cooperation. And our thoughts go out to our gallant allies in this war, to those who resisted the invaders, to those who were not strong enough to hold out, but who, nevertheless, kept the fires of resistance alive within the souls of their people, to those who stood up against great odds and held the line until the United Nations together were able to supply the arms and the men with which to overcome the forces of evil. This is a victory of more than arms alone. This is a victory of liberty over tyranny. From our war plants rolled the tanks and planes which blasted their way to the heart of our enemy. From our shipyards sprang the ships which bridged all the oceans of the world for our weapons and supplies. From our farms came the food and fiber for our armies and navies and for our allies in all the corners of the earth. From our mines and factories came the raw materials and the finished products which gave us the equipment to overcome our enemy. But back of it all were the will and spirit and determination of a free people who know what freedom is and who know that it is worth whatever price they had to pay to preserve it. It was the spirit of liberty which gave us our armed strength and which made our men invincible in battle. We now know that that spirit of liberty, the freedom of the individual, and the personal dignity of man are the strongest and toughest and most enduring forces in all the world. And so, on VJ Day, we take renewed faith and pride in our own way of life. We have had our day of rejoicing over this victory. We have had our day of prayer and devotion. Now let us set aside VJ Day as one of renewed consecration to the principles which have made us the strongest nation on earth and which, in this war, we have striven so mightily to preserve. Those principles provide the faith, the hope, and the opportunity which help men to improve themselves and their lot. Liberty does not make all men perfect, nor all society secure, but it has provided more solid progress and happiness and decency for more people than any other philosophy of government in history. And this day has shown again that it provides the greatest strength and the greatest power which man has ever reached. We know that under it we can meet the hard problems of peace which have come upon us. A free people with free allies who can develop an atomic bomb can use the same skill and energy and determination to overcome all the difficulties ahead. Victory always has its burdens and its responsibilities as well as its rejoicing. But we face the future and all its dangers with great confidence and great hope. America can build for itself a future of employment and security. Together with the United Nations, it can build a world of peace, founded on justice, fair dealing, and tolerance. As President of the United States, I proclaim Sunday, September the 2nd, 1945, to be VJ Day, the day of the formal surrender of Japan. It is not yet the day for the formal proclamation of the end of the war, nor of the cessation of hostility, but it is a day which we Americans shall always remember as a day of retribution, as we remember that other day, the day of infamy. From this day, we move forward. We move toward a new era of security at home. With the other United Nations, we move toward a new and better world of cooperation, of peace, and international goodwill. God's help has brought us to this day of victory. With His help, we will attain that peace and prosperity for ourselves and all the world in the years ahead.
President Harry Truman, as World War II officially came to an end. Even in the wake of that incredible victory and the crucial unity of purpose in this country that produced it, there were severe inequities, wrongs that needed to be righted, and historians today agree that Truman deserves credit for addressing them. In July 1946, in what Japanese Americans refer to now as the Day of Affirmation, the Nisei veterans of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team marched down Constitution Avenue to the ellipse of the White House, and President Truman decorated their colors with the Presidential Unit Citation. It was an acknowledgement by Truman not only of the unsurpassed courage of the 442,
Americans of Japanese ancestry fighting while many of their families remained behind barbed wire back home, but also of their loyalty, of their value, of the reality that they were just as American as anyone else. 2 years after that, Truman would issue Executive Order 9981, abolishing discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin in the U.S. Armed Forces. World War II had provided a canvas on which those Japanese Americans and also over 1 million African American servicemen and women, even in a segregated military, had demonstrated their ability, their bravery, their loyalty, and in so doing, exposed the foolishness of racial prejudice.
So, I think by now you probably have a pretty good grasp of how what happened 80 years ago has influenced the world we live in today. But we're going to add even more perspective when we come back. One of the men aboard the USS Missouri 80 years ago on September 2nd was a newly released prisoner of war. Get a taste of his experience when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode preparing you for one final World War II anniversary, September 2nd, and the signing of the Instruments of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri. I told you that World War II veterans will be on hand that day on the Missouri itself, now in Pearl Harbor, as well as in Washington, D.C. at the National World War II Memorial. There'll also be some World War II vets at the impressive Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial in Bakersfield, California, Tuesday, September 2nd at 10 a.m., and I've been invited to speak there, so if that's your area, we'd love to have you join us. A little further south in the Golden State is where William Sanchez grew up. He was still getting used to the taste of freedom again aboard the battleship USS Missouri 80 years ago because he had just been liberated after years of captivity. Sanchez had been captured on Corregidor. In fact, he had been ordered to destroy the American flag that had been flying there so it wouldn't fall into enemy hands.
We tried to preserve the flag itself so that it wouldn't fall into Japanese hands. We took the flag down and we hit it.
And it had been shot up a little bit, I guess, right?
It had a few shell shots on it, yes, quite a bit.
So did someone tell you to tear it into little pieces, or was that your idea?
No, it came about. I wouldn't say it was my idea, but it was the only thing we could think of. We tore it into little pieces so that it wouldn't fall into enemy hands. Once it was in little pieces, we just kept it. They wanted the flag in total, and they didn't have the chance to get it.
I'm just imagining, you know, obviously you're someone who signed up to defend your country, and now you're overseas in a very difficult situation defending your country, and now you're having to take apart the emblem of your country. Was that an emotional experience?
Yes, it was. But you had to accept it, and that's what we did.
Were there some tears during that process?
Yes, there was. Quite a few.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I believe that I heard you mention before or read about it, that you made a statement at the time as you're completing this task that you never asked for, that the situation presented to you, about hoping no one else ever had to do that, what you were doing.
That's right. It was a very bad experience. You can't forget that. You knew you were going to lose your freedom, so it was a hard thing to accept.
Did you ever think you were going to lose your life?
Yes, all the time. At any time, you figured this might be your last moment.
And when that surrender happened, you probably had no idea what to expect from the Japanese, right?
Right. We had no idea what was going to happen to us.
What did happen to you? What was the first thing they had you do?
Most of it was bad treatment and things that you don't really expect, but you have to endure.
And you were still a very young man.
I was a very young kid, yes.
You're in your early 20s. At this point, you're 23. Do you think that some of what you'd already endured in your life prepared you to handle that?
Yes. It was a good experience to be able to handle what was coming.
Mm.
And you don't wish it on other people.
So now you're a prisoner.
Yes.
And you have no idea how long you're going to be a prisoner.
That's the worst part.
So how did you face that? What gave you the strength or the hope to endure, to persist, to persevere?
Well, you never lose hope. You always think something better is going to happen. And you go on that basis. Things can't get worse.
But for you, as I understand your story, after you're a prisoner, they did get worse. The Japanese gave you a real brutal task.
The Japanese were real bad. It's something we had to learn to endure.
And they made you pile up all the bodies of the Americans and Filipinos who've been killed there?
Yes. They made us take care of all the bodies and everything, and we thought it would never end.
And then what did they do with those bodies that they forced you to gather?
Oh, they just piled them up, carted them up, and set fire to it. They weren't very kind. And all in all, it was a very bad experience. But it was something that had to be endured.
And so this is 1942. And as I said, you didn't know how long, but it was going to be a long time until you tasted freedom again.
Yes. It was a very difficult time at the time.
Can you help us understand what life in captivity was like and what some of the things you had to face and endure were?
It is very difficult to try to explain what we endured. It's unbelievable, but it happened.
Is it okay if I ask you a few questions about some of it?
Yes.
And I realize that this is something you had to survive one day at a time for more than 3 years.
You never knew what was going to happen the next day. From day to day, you learn to live life.
Were there some people that you were with that helped you?
We all helped each other. There was many bad things we had to learn to endure. And we all helped each other.
You know, one thing that I think most people listening can identify with or maybe can get a frame of reference from, since we all have to eat to survive, maybe people would be interested to hear what your menu consisted of as a prisoner of war.
Leftovers. What they didn't eat, they would feed us.
Is it fair to say that you ended up eating some things you never thought you'd eat?
That is true. It was a rough time in life that you don't even like to think about.
And we talked about you being a boxer, a good enough boxer that the Bruins wanted to give you a scholarship for it.
That's right.
So you're in pretty good physical shape before this happens.
Very good shape.
Uh-huh.
But that dwindled fast.
Yeah. So how much do you think you weighed before the war?
Oh, maybe 135 pounds or something. And we were down to about 100.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very difficult life overall and the way things happened.
And, you know, people today, some of the reference points they have to this experience, maybe one of the most well-known would be your friend Louis Zamperini, and they've seen the movie Unbroken or they've read that book by Laura Hillenbrand.
Yes.
Or read Louis's book.
Louis Zamperini happened to be in my camp, so I knew real well what he wrote about.
So when he wrote about being tortured?
Yes.
You experienced similar things?
Well, life itself was a torture. And it's just something you had to learn to endure.
How often did you think about your brother or your sister or your cousins, your family back here?
Quite often you think of what life is like to be with your family. Yes.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war give me different perspectives on some of the things they did in captivity to focus their minds or to remain hopeful. Some guys would daydream about all the things they were going to eat when they got out or the business they were going to start.
You always think about that, what you're going to eat when you get out. That's the primary thought.
So what was that for you? Was there something you were really looking forward to?
No, I just learned to accept things as they were and hope for something better. You learn to take it on a day-by-day basis because you can never do any planning or anything. It's a day-to-day thing.
And what were some of the things that the Japanese required you to do?
Whenever they could, they'd put us to work, and we would have to do labor and things that we were not accustomed of doing.
And I imagine if you're not eating much, you don't have much strength either.
Your energy level is very low, so you just do the best you can.
And how would they react if one of you was unable to do what they asked you to do?
They would do many unpleasant things that would make it difficult you to enjoy life as a whole. It's a difficult life all around. Just to survive was important. So that's what you thought of the most. How am I going to survive all this?
Well, and I guess that's the biggest question. As we look to your example and we marvel at the fact that you're still here and still able to tell this story, the biggest question is, how did you survive? How'd you do it?
It's a mind over matter thing. You have to think positive that eventually it's gonna end.
We mentioned Louis Zamperini, and if people have read his book, they know about the deal he made with God when he was floating on the raft.
Yeah, I was in the same camp with Louis Zamperini. So I knew most of his thinking because he would talk about things. It was just a bad situation overall.
Had you known who he was because of his track days at USC?
Well, yes, I knew who he was, and I was real close to him. We were just in a bad situation overall, and it was something we could not control.
And people who have read his book or seen the movie, one of the characters that was a real-life character that they'll never forget after digesting that was a guy he called the Bird. I think you had another nickname for him,
right?
Well,
the Bird was the disciplinary officer, and he was in charge of discipline on all the prisoners.
And you called him the Wily Bird?
That's what we named him, the Wily Bird.
Watanabe was his name.
He would always come up with things that were not too pleasant.
We got the sense from Louis's stories, and I had him on this program sharing his story, that the Bird almost seemed to enjoy picking on you American prisoners.
He preferred the American rather than the British and the other prisoners they had, because they felt they were overwhelmed by the Americans.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm just using that as a reference point because I know what Louis said about him, that he became the kind of figure that a lot of you prisoners would fear or would try to avoid if you could.
Well, you always tried to avoid the Japanese, especially the disciplinary officers. They were brutal.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can give us an example of that, of how they carried out that discipline.
Well, they wouldn't feed you if they felt they didn't had to, and it's just things that you don't expect. You expect a decent thing, and they do the reverse.
There's a well-known example that Louis told that is depicted in the film Unbroken, which you got to go to the premiere for with your son as a special guest. There's a scene in that film where they show Louis holding a railroad tie.
Yeah.
Did that really happen?
It actually happened. Yes, it did.
And is that something you were subjected to also?
Yes. We were all subjected to something of a kind. There was no exceptions.
And anybody who's seen that, just seen it depicted on film when it's not even really real, they can imagine and try to run through in their mind, how would I handle that? How would I try to survive that?
Yes. It is very difficult to imagine things that happen that are actually happening. You just learn to endure them.
Were there ever days where you woke up and felt, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
Many, many a day. How much longer do I have to do this?
And again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just wanting to understand how you really felt and what your experience was really like. But a situation like that, those circumstances that no one would ever choose, how does that affect your view of God or your feeling as to whether it's worthwhile to pray or if anyone's ever going to help you? Is that something that was relevant for you?
Sometimes you wonder if there's any help. It's very difficult to go through the things you have to endure because where do they come up with these ideas? It's not an easy life.
And I don't want to leave anything out that would be important to you, but one thing I'm sure that a lot of people would be interested in and hopefully is a little more pleasant memory for you. And I know there's a lot of things that happened over the time from the time you became a prisoner to when you were liberated. But help me understand what it was like when you guys started to realize, hey, the end is near and we may get to taste freedom again.
It's a very, very good feeling to think that you're going to have freedom again. Just the thought of it makes it exceptional. You always think the best is going to happen. You never think of the worst. It's always the best.
Where were you, and can you help me understand what it was like when that taste of freedom finally showed up again?
Oh, exhilarating. I was a prisoner in a prison camp when they finally decided to surrender. And boy, that was a great day.
How did you hear about it?
They let us know about it. That such and such is going to happen. And they made you aware of everything, so we were pretty much up to date on what is happening.
Did the Japanese treat you differently after that news?
Well, they had no power at all. The Americans took care of us and what our needs were. But it was a great feeling just to be free. It was just something you experience once in a lifetime, freedom. You realize what the word freedom really means.
And you've had a long time to look back on those days.
I would never want to go through it again.
And we certainly don't blame you. We wouldn't want to go through it either.
Life can be beautiful.
Well, I'm just wondering what kind of perspective your experience as a prisoner added to your life since then?
Well, you learn to look at things differently, and you never know what to expect. But there are difficult things in life that are going to happen, and you have to learn to accept them.
So when you got liberated, what was the first thing you wanted to do?
Have something good to eat.
What was it?
Well, anything. Something good. Just have a good feeling that you're eating something pleasant.
What was the worst thing you ever had to eat as a prisoner?
Oh, gosh. We ate mostly scraps, so there was nothing good about lunchtime. Things were tough, and we knew we had to endure them.
And before you came home, back to California, you actually ended up in a very unique place on September 2nd, 1945, 2.5 weeks or so after the Japanese declared their intent to surrender. They actually had some dignitaries that came aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay and signed the instruments of surrender.
Yes.
And we've seen the pictures. General MacArthur was there, and Admiral Nimitz was there, and this skinny General Wainwright was there.
All the big shots were there, yes. That was a happy day for all of us.
Well, and somebody else was there.
MacArthur.
How about Sanchez?
Yeah, I was right in the middle of things. But we were so grateful just to be free. It made all the difference in the world.
How did you end up on the Missouri that day for that ceremony?
They took us there. They made a special thing to take us to be present there at the Missouri. And we just accepted the occasion. It's good to be free.
So you took advantage of that freedom?
That's right.
When you came back to the States?
Yes.
Was there any thought in your mind about remaining in the Army and making it a career?
No. I wanted to get into life itself.
So you took advantage of the GI Bill?
Yes.
Went to college?
Went to college and accepted what I learned and took advantage of it.
You got to go back to Japan?
Yes, I did.
Not too long ago?
Yes.
With some other ex-prisoners of war?
That's right.
What were some of the things you got to do there, and what was it like for you all those years later?
Well, the one thing is you get treated so differently that you begin to wonder, where was all this happening? You know, it just makes things so different to go back and pay a visit. You wonder how it all could happen. It was a very difficult experience and one that you will never forget. You wonder how one human can be as bad to another as it happened. It's so good to enjoy freedom. You don't realize it till you lose it.
Most of us will never know that feeling, Lord willing, but we can allow our view of freedom to be shaped by those who have. 80 years after the official end of World War II, we can hold on to that truth we conclude with each week on Hometown Heroes. Freedom is not free.